Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello, and welcome to The Critic Books podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, and this week I'm speaking to Lucasta Miller. Lucasta Miller is a writer and literary journalist. Her most recent book is Keats, A Brief Life in 9 Poems and 1 Epitaph. For the May issue of The Critic, she reviewed Emma Smith's book, Portable Magic, which is what I'm going to be talking to her about today. So, welcome to The Critic podcast. I'm here with Lucasta to discuss her review of Emma Smith's Portable Magic, which is a book which came out last month. So it's lovely to have you here. Thank you so much for coming.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Emma Smith is a Shakespeare scholar, and her most recent book, Portable Magic, A History of Books and Their Readers, is kind of a bibliography.
Yes, I suppose it's, in the genre of bibliography, i.e. the study of books. But it takes the study of books into something much wider than you'd imagine. It's not a sort of, it's not in any way a sort of dusty book about books. It's full of zest and also just full of questions. It asks questions about, how is it that we respond to books? It's basically a series of sort of loosely connected essays about the cultural and, well, a political and emotional and in particular material history of the book.
I think it's really interesting. There's a line in it, isn't there, which she quotes somebody as describing the book as the white man's fetish. We kind of are obsessed with the book, not just for their contents, but for their material existence as well.
Absolutely, and that quote comes from some unnamed African being questioned, I think, by an anthropologist probably quite a long time ago. And it really sort of picks up on the inordinate meaning that Western culture has sort of invested in the book, meanings that aren't always rational. It suggests that the book is a sort of mysterious, almost mystical object, which it has been, at many times and in many cultures. And even where the book is used in Western culture as a sort of symbol of sort of rational progress and the Enlightenment, those sort of things, we still find people responding to books in a deeply emotional and often quite strange way. I mean, one example that I'm thinking of is the way that in the, I think it was the early 1960s, Joe Orton and his lover defaced all these library books that they got out of the Islington Public Library. And in this rather sort of ludic, surrealist, sort of Monty Python-ish way, they've done things like sort of stick a picture of a gorilla in the middle of a rose in a gardening manual, or change the title of a book from Night Must Fall to Knickers Must Fall. Today these are kept in the Islington Library as an amazing example of gorilla art. At the time, the pair were sent to prison for 6 months, and the judge in the case described what they'd done as disastrous. And I think this tells you something about the value placed on books in our culture, and that, of course, is goes back centuries to the Bible and to the fact that it's a religion of the book, and that's the most important ideological influence on our culture over the last few centuries.
I think that Joe Orton case you mentioned about the Islington Public Library is so interesting, because the couple were sentenced to 6 months in prison, which at the time in 1959 was the same sentence given to a person who killed another person in a drink driving incident. So the defacement of books was put on the same level almost.
Yes, Emma Smith asks all sorts of really interesting ethical questions about our attitude to books. Milton in Areopagitica, his famous plea for free speech, says books are not absolutely dead things. They do contain a potency of life in them. And he goes on to say that, almost as good as to kill a man is to kill a good book. And this idea has gone on through history, with Heine, for example, saying that where you first burn books, then you'll end up burning people. And we do indeed get, for example, the Nazis burning, I think it was 90,000 books in the 1930s. Interestingly, at that time in 1933, Newsweek used the word Holocaust to talk about a Holocaust of books. And of course, we now use the word Holocaust to talk about genocide. Emma Smith looks at this with quite a thoughtful eye, and she, you know, she basically comes down on the, you know, states the common sense viewpoint, which is actually it really isn't as bad to destroy a book as it is to kill a person. She's interested in why we might equate biblicide with genocide, and all the different ideas that become involved with that. But she's also really got her feet on the ground. That's another thing I absolutely love about Emma Smith and the way she writes. She's got a fantastically lively and accessible sort of conversational voice. And at the same time, I mean, you know, it's absolutely not written in the sort of jargon-ridden vocabulary of academic theory. Although, of course, it is seriously backed up with, you know, really proper scholarship. I mean, the ideas and the material in it isn't dumbed down at all, but the voice is really fresh and makes you feel like you're just sort of listening to her talk. On the other hand, she'll also bring in some really rather sort of exotic vocabulary, which of course she'll explain. But I loved sort of learning new words like skeuomorphic. I didn't know what the skeuomorphic design is, when a new technology apes the sort of the previous version. So yeah, so I mean, so for example, when you get you know, the sort of e-readers where it sort of mimics the idea of you turning the page, that would be a bit of skeuomorphic design. And she points out that the Gutenberg Bible also was like that, in that it was, you know, it was sort of aping the handwritten versions of books that came before. And also it was a great big book at a time when actually the fashion in books was to have them smaller and smaller and more for private perusal.
Yeah, I think that's so fascinating. When you talk about her style, Emma Smith is obviously famous as a Shakespeare scholar and used to do a brilliant podcast series of introducing people to Shakespeare plays. And I think it's the same kind of democratizing knowledge, which is really important in her scholarship.
Absolutely, but also the fact that the Shakespeare book began as these podcasts, they began as the spoken word. She writes as if she, I mean, she could just read it out and it would be an incredible podcast. It's not, you know, the difference between orality and literacy, as she might put it in her book, is really not very much in her written voice. And it's actually much harder to do that than you'd think as a writer.
And it's completely interesting to think of that when it is a book about bookhood and how important it is for it to be so oral in a way.
Exactly. And I actually, there are so many questions that I wanted to ask Emma Smith herself about how she feels about this book of hers, its journey going out into the world, how people are going to receive it, how we're going to experience it, how we're going to handle it. She's really, really hot on the idea of books as you said, as these physical objects. Even the smell of them. One of the funny things that she notes is that rare books librarians apparently have a sort of, you know, some sort of system whereby they log the different, a chart to for the different smells of old books. And that made me think of, you know, once I had a friend who was indeed an expert in, she was a rare books librarian. She told me about a friend of hers who developed a strange sort of rash or sort of fungal thing on the end of their nose. And it turned out that this person, who at the time was a graduate student, had been sitting in the library over these ancient tomes and had obviously fallen asleep. And they'd caught some fungal infection from some ancient book. I don't know if that's true, but Emma Smith certainly has a story about a 16th century edition of Augustine with the residue of a currant bun inside it.
It's absolutely brilliant, isn't it?
I know.
I used to do a lot of research in the Western Library in Oxford, and you go in, you have to leave everything, you're only allowed a pencil, and you go in, and you have to prop up the books on a thing that supports their spine. There's a very interesting line in your review where you talk about how having books, having spines, makes them feel like a kind of human twin to us in a way. And, of course, Emma Smith has a chapter on books which are printed on human skin or bound in human skin, which is incredibly disturbing. And
it is. Yeah. I mean, it actually makes me feel almost physically sick thinking about it. Because one of the things that's good about this book is that although Emma Smith adores books, she's in love with the book, but she's also aware of the book as, you know, as possibly a dangerous or even or disturbing or even immoral object. And these books, which are literally bound in human skin, people used to assume that it was a bit of a myth that there was such a thing as books bound in human skin, but some of them have been DNA tested, and it turns out it's true. The way they dehumanise the, I don't know what you call it, the donors of the skin, is quite horrific. I mean, one of them, you can sort of understand, I mean, you can't sort of condone it, but it's a medical textbook, and the skin is that of a pauper Irish woman who died of consumption in the 19th century. I mean, it's appalling. But when it comes to the works of the 18th century African-American poet Phyllis Wheatley being bound in human skin for no apparent reason, it just brings up all the sort of darkest sides of unspoken racism. I mean, it's all about skin. It's really, really quite disturbing that these things were sort of valued by book collectors. There's a, you know, Emma Smith does talk quite a bit about book collecting. For example, about a book collector who, a very wealthy book collector who died on the Titanic, I think, clutching a volume of Francis Bacon. And the motivation behind collecting is another sort of, is another interesting area that she goes into. On the other hand, there are aspects of owning particular, you know, copies of books that, you know, we can all identify with. I mean, that particular childhood edition of whatever your favourite book was, no other version will ever do. No modern copy will do. And, you know, or, you know, even if it's damaged, the damage will become, you know, part of its identity and part of that emotional connection you have with it.
It completely does. And I find Emma Smith's comment on book collecting as well. She talks about how a book, if a book isn't read, is it really a book? Which is quite an interesting idea, because I think we now live in a world where, like, the antiques market, obviously, and rare books are so valuable that people then buy them not to touch them and not to read them, because that would lessen their value if they were to be opened and broken, which is also a really interesting idea.
It's quite horrible, isn't it? It is. I mean, I think it's wonderful the way that in many libraries you still can go and look at wonderful rare books. I mean, I remember when I was just starting working on my book on Keats, I wanted to look physically at the first edition of his first volume of poems, because I've always thought it's really, really important to have some knowledge of the, you know, the format in which something was published, what it looked like, you know. I mean, simply having the text, you know, it just isn't enough, and that's one of the things that Emma Smith will tell us. I mean, if you know, the typeface matters, the, you know, and so in calling up this first edition of Keats's poems, which, you know, which wasn't, you know, he was an unknown, the print run was tiny, there aren't that many, and it's not, you know, like a Gutenberg Bible, but there aren't that many left. And the fact that you can just go to the British Library and you can order it up and you can handle it and read it, I love that.
It's so special. It's such a privilege as well.
It absolutely is. And so I was thinking about Keats's, the first poem that really got him noticed, which was on First Looking Into Chapman's Homer. And it's about how inspired he felt reading George Chapman's Elizabethan translation of the Odyssey and Iliad. And I which of course would have been an old sort of antique vintage book at the time Keats read it. And he had gone round to a friend's house and together they'd looked through this borrowed copy of Chapman, and they'd been incredibly excited, particularly by the sort of the gritty muscularity of that Elizabethan Jacobean style compared to the polite language of Alexander Pope and the sort of, you know, the 18th century poets, the rhyming couplets. Anyway, so I went to the British Library and I ordered up Keats's 1817 volume of poems, his first collection, and Chapman's Homer in probably the same edition that that Keats and his friend would have looked at. And of course the Chapman is enormous, it's got this very sort of grand title on the front, a sort of beautifully designed title page with gods and goddesses and things. Keats is tiny in comparison, it's very modest, although it does have an illustration on the title page, which is a portrait, I think probably of Shakespeare. Other people thought maybe it's of Spenser, but it does link to his fascination with and the inspiration he got from those poets of that earlier era. And what's so amazing now is that, of course, the Keats book is much more sought after than the Chapman, even though it's not as old. And if you want to buy one, it'll set you back, I can't remember what it was, but, you know, tens of thousands of pounds, whereas you could probably get an original Chapman for sort of £6,000 or £7,000.
I was doing some research on first edition Ulysses the other day, and there's one for sale at Peter Harrington currently for £300,000.
Yep, well, I'm not surprised, because of course it was produced in a limited edition, wasn't it?
And it's beautiful in that beautiful colour of blue, but it's just fascinating to think we value those things so highly. I mean, buy a house for that.
Absolutely, I know. It is extraordinary. And I mean, I wonder if that was really a product of the 19th century, sort of market for collecting.
Yeah, it's really interesting when they're prized on the same level as artworks or something, things that are made to just be looked at, but yeah, they do.
Yes. Yeah. But going back to what you were saying before, I mean, I think Emma Smith talks about how, you can, if you're sort of, you know, terribly rich, you can get your interior designer to give you sort of ready-made shelves full of books that will just give the right impression to your visitors and sort of imply that you're... that you're frightfully clever or something.
At least you want to bang my head against a wall.
I know.
Yeah, you can understand it. Books have become, I think, so wrapped up with like class and status as well. The idea of being very intellectual, the shelfie.
Absolutely, yeah. That's so true. I just had a weird experience last week because I, for about over 10 years, I've been looking after a collection of handwritten early 19th century albums, like these commonplace books made mostly by middle-class women in the period from about 1810 to 1860. And they had belonged to a wonderful literary scholar called William St. Clair, who sadly, very sadly, died last summer. And now that, which is wonderful news, they're going to go to the special collections at the UCL library. And so having lived with these volumes for so long, I only looked after them because William was such a sort of bibliophile that his own flat was piled with so many books, he simply didn't have enough room for these ones too. I'd lived with these volumes and I'd occasionally sort of pick them off the shelf and it was just a wonderful insight into the lives and the minds of these people living in the early 19th century, which of course was a time when mass print was huge, it was really expanding, and people wanted to make their own handwritten anthologies almost in reaction to the primacy of print, I think.
I've always adored the commonplace tradition, starting really early. I think it's such a fascinating idea. So people would have these books and they'd write their headings at the top of different pages and then they would copy things into them that would match up to those headings. Or you could buy books with the headings pre-typed out for you and then fill them in yourself. But there's this idea that you make your own book collated of all the things that really matter to you, which is
exactly
so fascinating.
Exactly, and also it really goes... And what I found interesting... I mean, William was his most... one of his greatest books, of the books he wrote himself, was called Reading Nation in the Romantic Period, and he analysed, you know, what did people actually read in the Romantic Period? You know, we remember Keats and Shelley, but, you know, what were, you know, he looks at publishing data and looks at actual sales figures, and this was one of the reasons why he collected these albums. And then I was working on a writer of the 1820s and 30s called Letitia Landon, who, you know, he's hardly heard of at all today. But in fact, if you look at these commonplace books, her poems are copied out again and again. And so it gives you a sort of insight into the taste of the time. It also gives you an insight into the way that people, you know, people's lives as they sort of move through different periods of their existence. So one of them had a very racy love poem by Letitia Landon from the early 1820s that the owner of the album must have copied out when she herself was quite young. But later on, someone, we assume a child, has cut out a picture from an advert for Fitch's Firelighters and coloured it in and stuck it on top. And I was imagining, you know, so this young woman with all these sort of romantic, you know, sort of aspirations, grows up, gets married, has a family, and then her commonplace book she's not really interested in anymore, so she gives it to her child, who then cuts out pictures from a magazine and sticks them on.
I think it's so fascinating as well to think about in the 19th century, because there are a couple of examples of very early medieval women's books that were kind of handed between families, and a lot of women would write into them, and they were kind of in dialogue with each other, the poems they were copying out, which is so fascinating.
It is
as well.
Fascinating, yeah. And also just the way that even in a family Bible you get people writing out, you know, just information about, you know, births and deaths and things, but it still gives you that enormous connection between, you know, the book and human lives. And one of the things that I think Emma Smith's book, you know, brought home to me is the way that books have this sort of paradoxical ability both to sort of cheat death but also to sort of underline our mortality.
Completely. One of my most prized possessions, actually, is a really, really, really battered copy of Jane Eyre that I used at school. And I used it at school because my mum had given it to me, and it was my mum's at school. And inside, signed with her maiden name, which is really lovely. And there are notes from her to her friends written in the margins all the way around. It's just so special. I mean, the actual text of Jane Eyre is so obscure by this point, but it's so special to see all those things.
Oh, yeah, well, and marginalia. Yeah. And my husband told me that somebody told him they'd seen a copy in a library of my book about the Brontes, the Bronte myth, in which some reader had changed my first name, Lucasta, to Lucifer. That really worried me.
I love that. There is, if anyone's interested in finding it, there is a Facebook group called, I can't remember what it's called, I think it's called like Bizarre Library Marginalia, and you can share it all.
Yeah.
I admit that's quite a nerdy pastime. Maybe this would be a good time actually to talk about your book, The Bronte Myth, because you were writing about a kind of meta history about how the Brontes have lived on in their books and books about them. And I wondered if there was something that we could tie to this idea of books having, as you said, cheating death, that kind of afterlife-y thing there.
Oh God, it reminds me of a time when I mean, my book about the Brontes, it's more a book about, it's sort of, yeah, as you put it very well, but it's almost more a book about biography about the Brontes' reception than it almost is about the Brontes themselves. And the time I was writing it, you know, I'd come out of studying English at Oxford at a time when, you know, French post-structuralist theory was the thing, and it was all about the death of the author, and it really wasn't about authors as human beings, and things like biography were almost sort of, not exactly sneered at, but slightly looked down on. I remember one critic saying something like, ontological anxieties do not penetrate the biographer. Which I can tell you, jolly well isn't the case if you've ever tried to reconstruct the facts of someone's life. Anyway, But I had this personal interest in biography, and yet I had quite a sort of complicated emotional attitude to, you know, how sentimental is it if I'm really, really emotional about the writers that I'm working on. Then I had this experience in the Pierpont Morgan Library
when I happened to be there, in fact, to look at something different, because I was interested in Charlotte Bronte's posthumous reputation and how her father had cut up pieces of her letters to give to fans who were all writing to him to ask for examples of her handwriting. But since I was there, I thought, oh, I'll also call up this other manuscript, which was a little bit of diary fragments written by Charlotte Bronte when she was a young teacher, very frustrated at a school called Roehead. And I got this little bit of manuscript up in front of me. It's written in this tiny handwriting, very characteristic of the Brontes. And it's clearly a very, very personal, it's sort of her fantasies, really. And it suddenly felt, firstly, like this moment of extraordinary transgression. I mean, you know, this piece of paper was just given to me. No gloves, no plastic in front of it, just a really sort of intimate. And it really, really moved me. But unfortunately, I suddenly felt this enormous tear in the corner of my eye. I just managed to sort of move my head away to one side before it landed on the priceless manuscript. But yes, so that's just another example of how the written word can, connect. We connect with it in a very sort of non-rational way, often very emotional.
Completely. And I'm just looking at the copy of Emma Smith's book, which is a beautiful book. I mean, not in proof, but in the final version. And just wondering how it will live on as well. I mean, yeah.
Absolutely. And that's what I'd love to ask her about, and how she'd like her book to live on, and how she imagines readers reading it. One thing I love about this book, which she does actually mention in her introduction, is that because it's created as a series of essays, you can actually read them in any order you like. And I love that because I'm really not the ideal reader. My family sort of can't stand the way that I will often read the end of a story first. Well, not first, but I'll sort of flick around. That's one of the wonderful things you can do with the book as technology. Because she also talks about how the codex, which is what they used before, which is basically a scroll on two sticks, like, like the Torah in a synagogue, you can't open it up at more than one place. You can't sort of cross-refer between two places at once. And so I imagine Romans had to read much more sequentially.
Yeah, there's a very interesting academic essay, I can't remember who wrote it, about how that changed the way we read the Bible. We now cross-reference Old and New Testament and also different, Psalms, different passages. You pick up words and then you flick to see where else they occur. But we couldn't do that.
Of course. You can't do that
if you're reading on a PDF.
Absolutely. So the technology of the book actually influenced the way in which biblical scholarship, arose. And so it would be really, I know that in the Islamic tradition, it's much more about memorizing the text of the Quran. And I don't, it would just be fascinating to do a sort of comparative cultural study of the way in which, belief systems have grown up because of the sort of delivery systems that information have had.
Completely, and there's that very early modern tradition as well, isn't there, of the paratext and the margins of pointing out where you can cross-reference yourself or what this should teach you. Like reading in dialogue or something else, which is so fascinating. Well, thank you so much for that. That was absolutely brilliant. I think we'll talk about this forever. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.